My name's Tom Jennings, this is the 24 Frames cast, and this episode is going to be the first part of the 2024 70mm Film Festival. If you are not familiar with these shows, I urge you to go back and listen to the previous years. How this works is I pick two bona fide 70mm films to begin and end the festival. The other eight films are 70mm blow-ups. And I'm going to get right on with it with this year. I've gone for a pick for my first film in a format which I've never covered in these episodes. So do enjoy.
Cinema history was made in Glasgow. The newly named Coliseum Cinerama Theatre now seats 1,300. The sumptuous bars and all other appointments set a new standard in the great city's places of entertainment. The powder room, filmed on the one and only occasion our ace camel men have penetrated such fastnesses. To most people who will occupy these seats, Cinerama is still something of a mystery. The projection box seems like a scene out of science fiction, with its giant spools of film requiring machinery to hoist them into place. Fortunately, once there, each one runs for nearly an hour and a half.
Now, if you are unfamiliar with Cinerama, this was a format whereby three 35mm cameras would simultaneously capture an image that would in turn be projected onto the screen with three projectors. The screens were huge curved giants designed to immerse the viewer in the experience along with a 7-track audio surround sound. And of all the 70mm formats, Cinerama came with one of the biggest number of rather obvious drawbacks. So the first was the cost. The negative alone of a single film would cost a great deal, but to have three cameras and to shoot and print all of that material, you could begin to see why producers would get nervous using this format. And then there was the cost to exhibitors. Three projectionists, a huge screen to invest in, along with a massive sound system. And of course, there were other issues to contend with. If one projector became stuck or was damaged or slowed down, the entire film would become a nightmare to exhibit and a logistical pain in the ass. And the format had a number of other drawbacks for filmmakers. Sometimes the actors would warp slightly if they walked through the joins in the projector screen. Blocking then became a serious consideration. What do you do with characters and the setup of a scene? You could not use zoom lenses due to distortion, and of course there would be the sheer practical issue of involving a fast-moving camera setup. Of all the 70mm, Cinerama is the one, therefore, that has the most distinct film grammar, which came about by the format itself. And it is why, in my opinion, Cinerama films are better seen as quirky oddities, an interesting moment in the history of cinema, exhibition and production, even if the films themselves are hardly all that memorable. My first experience with the format was seeing This Is Cinerama, the format's calling card, projected in Bradford when I was at university. And the novelty wore off fairly quickly, but indeed the image was incredible. But This Is Cinerama quickly became a bit of a slog to get through. And it was released in 1952, and the film was followed 3 years later by Cinerama Holiday, a travelogue showing the best of America and Europe. And this was a colossal hit and was the highest grossing film of America that year. In 1956, this was followed by The Seven Wonders of the World, which was another huge hit. And 57 and 58, there was more travel films for Paradise and South Sea Adventure. Before a 5-year absence, the format would return with cinema's first fictional film, and it was the one I'm going to be talking about today. Now, How the West Was Won may be Cinerama's most well-known release, a huge tale of the making of the West, just about every Hollywood star you could think of, with three directors, one of which was John Ford. But it was not the first fictional film made in Cinerama. That was The Wonderful World of Brothers Grimm, and it's the film that I decided to kick this year's festival off.
Well, Grimm, how goes the work today?
Mr. Gruber, forgive me, I didn't know you were here.
Does my presence disturb you? Your hands are trembling.
My brother has not been feeling well, Mr. Gruber. His health is really not...
And still he continues to work. What heroic devotion to duty.
It's nothing.
On the contrary, Grimm. On the contrary, His Grace the Duke would be most grateful. and find ways to show it. May I examine the fruits of your labor?
But it isn't complete.
Wouldn't you rather wait until the entire manuscript...
No. No. And as he fell, he ceased to be a frog and turned into a prince with beautiful, kind eyes. And where does this event occur in the Duke's family history?
Well, I heard this little story, and while it was fresh in my mind, I thought I'd borrow just a few minutes.
Borrowed?
Borrowed.
You call it borrowing, do you? Stealing! You are stealing from the Duke, who is paying you to write his family history. When you steal from the Duke, you are committing a crime for which he could put you behind bars like any other thief. Need I say more, gentlemen?
Until recently, The Wonderful World of Brothers Grimm was the only Cinerama film not to have been given a remastering, with many fearing the original negatives were in such poor state, getting anywhere near its original glory would be quite impossible. Two film restoration experts, Tom March and Dave Stromheimer, worked hundreds of miles apart and using home computers running Adobe Create Sweep, have performed something of a minor miracle in getting the Brothers Grimm back to somewhere near its original appearance. Both Warner Bros. And the Cinerama Corporation have been delighted with their efforts, with a new 4K restoration hitting home video and a theatrical release where possible. And indeed, the Blu-ray is a marvel, both visually and sonic. And I played it in the Smilebox version, which is a lot of cinema releases you get. You will get two versions of the film. One will be the film framed in a kind of straight up widescreen way, and they do another film which is called the Smilebox version, which has a curvature to the sides and kind of gives you a more, I suppose, not the full Cinerama experience, but a kind of a more accurate representation of what it would have looked like when it was projected theatrically. And all of this is all well and good, but the crucial question is, was this film going to be the first kind of bona fide masterpiece lacking from the Cinerama stable I was hoping for? And the answer to that question really is sadly no. So what is the film about? Well, it's about the Brothers Grimm, Wilhelm and Jacob, and they've been commissioned to write a history of a local duke. Only William, played by Lawrence Harvey, cares more about jotting down his ideas for fairy tales, whilst brother Jacob, played by Carl Heinz Böhm, tries to get him back on track to finish the manuscript they're being paid to complete. The story becomes a kind of meta take on the creation of fairy tales, as well as a biography of the brothers themselves. It's ambitious, and it gleefully jumps through fat time and with fantasy and stop-motion puppets, fights with dragons, yet sadly suffers from all the pitfalls of other Cinerama productions. In the first instance, it is incredibly stagey, resembling filmed theatre more than cinema. And as I said at the top of this, Cinerama forced directors to make stylistic choices that they would not have made if they were working with another format. And the film had two directors, Henry Levine and George Powell, to cover the fairy tale sequences, and neither really seems to have gotten grips with the limitations of the Cinerama format. Because for all of its effects, costumes, art design, the film is formulaic to the point by it almost feels like it's paint by numbers in its stagings. Now, most Cinerama films have the action take place in the centre frame. They had to, really, as this was the nature of the format, with close-ups out of the questions, and the film becomes so visually predictable. And when the story isn't particularly gripping either, I did find myself beginning to tire of it quite quickly. And it does have some fun moments where I suppose they're kind of Cinerama gimmicks, some POV shots even on a smaller screen hit home, but gimmicks like jump scares are band-aids in lieu of actual substance. And of course, the film is a fairy tale of sorts, it's supposed to be frivolous, but that's what Disney was doing a lot better. And by the way, this does kind of serve as a origin story for many of the Disney tales. Certainly I detected some Snow White in there, and I did a little bit of research into the actual stories behind Snow White, and Definitely a lot more bleaker than I would have thought. But going back to the film, it did not really change my mind about Cinerama. I think it's an important piece of film history, and it was in response to the financial climate. It was an attempt at resurrecting the format of film and getting people to go to the cinema again. And Cinerama played an important part in doing that. The films it produced were incredibly popular. It did get people back out of their houses and going to the theatre. But as a thought, I think the format takes too much of a toll on the aesthetics of Cinerama films, and what's left never really gets above average. An amazing amount of love and effort went into restoring this film, and it deserves to be preserved. The film isn't necessarily about a single film, it's about an art form as a whole and the history behind it, and I'm glad that this restored version exists. We need it in terms of a film history point of view, and I think the Warner Brothers Blu-ray from the Warner Archive Collection is a genuine thing of beauty. Whilst watching it, my mind did go into wonder mode, and I have a brilliant idea for a remake, and I want a Guillermo del Toro version with Austrian violin player André Rieu on board in some kind of creative director role, and I think that might be the Brothers Grimm film that we've all been waiting for.
My name is Otto Preminger. I have just finished my film In Harm's Way. It tells of a handful of men and women right after the attack on Pearl Harbor. They were outnumbered. Their ships had no radar. Their guns were rusty. But they had guts, the will to survive, to win.
Sometimes when I watch a film that I honestly have no idea how I feel about, I have an urge to rewatch it almost immediately. More so than I do when I watch a film that I've loved every minute of. I remember watching Under the Skin and simply leaving the cinema in awed bliss. Viewing number 2 could wait until the Blu-ray. The film was a masterpiece, end of, and I wanted time to process it and let it sleep into my psyche. Other films, however, can be tricky affairs. Although they may not be terrible or particularly good, you don't want to heap praise or scorn on them either way. They exist in a kind of void, a kind of film purgatory, if you will. And my second choice for this series festival is a film that, despite watching twice, I honestly have no idea how I feel about. I don't know if I could honestly recommend it, but one thing I did garner from viewing number 2 is at least this is a film that is trying to do something slightly different, which actually might be its biggest problem. It is Otto Preminger's 1965 film In Harm's Way. It is an epic war film with the action taking its place from Pearl Harbor to the American fight back in the Pacific. John Wayne plays Captain Rockwell Torrey, Rock for short, who is stripped of his command following the attack on Pearl Harbor and finds solace in nurse Maggie, played by Patricia Neal. His estranged son just happens to be dating her roommate, and Rock has to deal with wayward friend Paul, played by Kirk Douglas, who has a bit of a thing for the ladies and not in a healthy way. Along the way, there is suicide, rape, the war, and some not entirely convincing romances. And despite being set in World War II, In Harm's Way is a very modern film in its contemporary context. Filmed in 1964, the film looks like it was made in 1964. Indeed, its opening, which takes place at a Navy dance on the eve of the Pearl Harbor attack, actually made me honestly believe at first I was watching a scene set in the 1960s and we were about to go into a flashback. It wasn't, and indeed it was, as I mentioned, on the eve of Pearl Harbor. And the production didn't use historically accurate equipment either, so all the warships look surprisingly technologically advanced for their time they're supposed to be set in. And I don't expect films to be historical documents. I mean, indeed, one of my favourite films ever is Patton, which used the Spanish army in the 1970s to display it for the Germans, and you can tell they're using very modern equipment. But I did find myself questioning the reality of the films at times. And indeed, I think it was deliberate to a degree, as In Harm's Way is trying to appeal to a very broad audience. You have a mixture of youth and maturity in the choice of actors. John Wayne, Burgess Meredith, Kirk Douglas, and then a younger, fresh-faced, good-looking cast beneath them. And much of the conversations that take place in the film are about going to parties, women and coming and going in men's lives. It feels like it is trying to be hip, and despite looking good, you realise that In Harm's Way is narratively very thin, and Otolo Premier pads the film with scenes that seem to go on way longer than is actually necessary. And it's a very talky affair, therefore. And what's annoying is that so many of the scenes don't really seem to have all much to them. They're long exchanges of information that are hardly gripping, to say the least. And much of In Harm's Way involves people walking from one thing to the next, or simply arriving at different places. And it doesn't make for the most exciting of viewing experience, and Premier's direction feels flat a lot of the time. And you begin to wonder, what is the point of all this? Where is it going? Do I really care about any of this that I'm watching? And if you're asking those types of questions whilst watching a film, it could be that it's a sign that you're watching a dud. However, there is a kind of charm to the Wayne-Patricia Neal friendship. Wayne's performance has been described as a bit low-key. This was in part due to the fact he had lung cancer, but I actually like him how he is in this. He is a flawed hero for sure, a crap father, world-weary, but he's legitimately seems like a man whose experience of life have taught him that his age, pleasure should comes to him, should be embraced at all costs. And in Maggie, he's very much met a sort of soulmate. She too is genuinely well-written character. She is actively in pursuit of him, and Neil injects her with spunk that never borders on the sassy. She seems like a person who knows exactly what she wants and can't be bothered playing hard to get. It's refreshing, and despite the age difference, their relationship works on screen, and the film's best moments are between these two characters.
Maggie.
Hello, sailor.
Pleasant surprise.
You're not easy to talk to on the phone, so I've decided to ambush you.
Sit down. Can I offer you a drink?
No, nothing, thanks. My unit's ordered to report to Fort Island in the morning at 6. We weren't told any more than that, but it can only mean one thing.
You'll be at sea by noon, Maggie.
Did you know I was going?
I knew there was a convoy pulling out.
Wouldn't like to give me a hint about our destination.
You know, I can't do that. You'll be told after you sail.
It's a long way.
Long way.
Then we won't meet again in what's called the foreseeable future, right?
Right.
You think we'd better let it go at that?
But with so many subplots, many of which seem completely unnecessary, the film's focus is constantly shifting from character to character, from situation to situation, and I never felt the film found its core. However, there is just enough happening to maintain your interest in it. The Kirk Douglas story arc took me by surprise, and when what transpires with that character, you realise that, for want of a better word, this is a film to a degree that is about toxic masculinity. And it doesn't glorify the American military. It's bureaucratic. It fights within itself. It makes mistakes. And I did enjoy the war scenes as well. It feels suitably huge when out of the domestic environment, and Lloyd Griggs on director of photography duties does a great job with Panavision and a black and white frame. He was also nominated for an Academy Award for his efforts for it, and I can see why. It's got a great score by Jerry Goldsmith, and it's one of his better early ones that holds up pretty well, and you can certainly hear some of the origins that would go into the film pattern here as well. And overall, it's a mixed bag. Its tonally shifts jar. And if you feel you were more focused in a leaner way, In Harm's Way could have been something far greater, I believe. Instead, what we have is a largely plodding affair that labours under having too many characters and a lack of narrative focus. Yet despite all this, I would watch this film, but again, it's easy going for the most part. It doesn't demand your reserved attention, and with long winter's night kicking in, it's the type of thing a miserable Sunday might just be made for. Now, in 70 terms of 70mm, I couldn't find that too many facts about this one. However, it was the first 70mm to be blown up and shown in Australia. So, and I think the Blu-ray, I think looks and sounds absolutely brilliant. They've done a great job with this. So overall, this is a recommendation with caveats.
The screen stretches to vast new horizons in the epic story of a rabble regiment. Led by two bitter enemies, a major in blue, a captain in gray. To this day, their exploits echo in the legendary of the great Southwest. Fall in, behind the major. Fall in, behind the major.
Now, if I was a major Hollywood studio executive in the 1960s and needed a director who would shepherd my 4.5 million epic through production smoothly with zero fuss, I most likely would not have hired Sam Peckinpah for the job. One of Hollywood's most notoriously troublesome artists, Peckinpah was many things: a tyrant, a drunk, a drug addict, a great friend, an inspiration, kind, funny, cruel, but most of all, an uncompromising film director whose vision often led him to in conflict with those around him. He had made his name in television with shows such as The Westerner, starring Keith David, and he had directed two films, The Deadly Companions, 1961, and the acclaimed Ride of the High Country in 1962, before getting the chance to direct Charlton Heston in the film Major Dundee in 1965. The film was going to be a major roadshow production, a prestige picture, with Heston as probably the biggest star working in Hollywood at the time, and Peckinpah developed the script with Oscar Sewell with a view to crafting an intense character piece. Heston liked it, so what could possibly go wrong on this production? Well, firstly, there was the budget. Set at a then huge 4.5 million, it was cut to 3 million before production began, and Sam Peckinpah was already by this time drinking a lot, and tension between star and director grew. Throw into the mix the likes of Richard Harris and James Coburn, and you have a set which is often chaotic, and this would filter back to the studio, who began to panic. Executives were becoming increasingly concerned that the production had become out of control. Now, despite his disagreements with the director, Heston forfeited his salary in order to keep the production going, and Peckinpah in the role of director, who was considered being sacked by the studio. Producer Jerry Bresler eventually saw fit to take the film off Peckinpah, and along with Heston, recut the film to their liking. Now, of course, with film history and film fans, we love to make bold claims that had it not been for studio interference, such and such a film would have been a masterpiece, hands down. And certainly when his testimony of friends or acquaintance of director that have had their work removed from them, they're often very quick to lament what could have been. In the case of Major Dundee, we do have an extended version, which is the one that I saw, but it's still far from the full cut Peckinpah envisaged. I believe his first draft, I understand, was about 4.5 hours, which even for a roadshow production would have been a fairly ridiculous runtime. And it's hard on, I think, to see how that film didn't need to be cut down. But the studio did back Major Dundee. Indeed, it ended up going $1.5 million over budget. But thanks to Heston, Major Dundee would eventually be finished, and it did go $1.5 million over budget. But I'm still not sure that Major Dundee could have ever, or indeed was ever, going to be the masterpiece of the genre. The plot has drawn comparisons to Moby Dick. Dundee, played by Heston, as a kind of Ahab character, desperately trying to tack down an Apache war party, murdering and pillaging their way along the border of New Mexico. His ragtag bag of men is complemented by black soldiers, Confederate prisoners led by Richard Harris, playing a character called Captain Tyreen. And It's an uneasy alliance beset with fractured loyalties, racial tensions, and personal animosities. The problem, I believe, with the film is that Major Dundee feels like a Sam Peckinpah film with the brakes on. There's nuggets in there, and you can clearly tell his love of Mexico, beautiful women, and of course that trademark violence. But Peckinpah doesn't share his films. He is the film. And by putting him in a major Hollywood production with all that entails, I just don't think it was ever really going to work. And you can see there's elements in the film which don't feel like he wanted him there. Pointless narration telling us what's going on. Heston being given a never-ending series of hero shots, and a plot that, despite its initial premise, becomes unfocused and at times frankly rather lacking. Plotting would be the best word to describe it. And normally with Peckinpah, you're gripped from the get-go. A recent screening of Cross of Iron had me glued to the seat. It was impossible to take my eyes off the screen. And Major Dundee, despite its widescreen grandeur, is never able to provide a gripping cinematic experience. And I wonder if the problem lies with the screenplay. Did Peckinpah, Harry Fink and Oscar Saul need to pare down the script and make it more focused, lose some subplots and some characters? And I rather get the impression that the film had a huge canvas to fill and nobody quite knew what was going to go into it. But don't get me wrong, there's plenty to enjoy. This feels like one of the earliest revisionist westerns. It's violent, and of course it's a Peckinpah film, and no one does violence like him because no one better understands what violence was at that point in the world of cinema. Peckinpah was not glorifying the act, he was showing us how horrifying it is. And you can see the early genesis of this in Major Dundee. It's far more graphic than many of its peers, and for Peckinpah, completist, you can easily see his style and grammar being shaped that would, of course, involve much more into the next film, The Wild Bunch. I don't dislike Major Dundee, it's often gorgeous to look at, and I have a man crush on Heston. But I just don't see that there was ever anything in this film than a slightly above average western. It's well acted, it's often beautiful, and for Peckinpah fanatics, it's going to be of interest. And I think it will grow on me. I'm still very lukewarm on it at the moment. And I think it's going to be one of those films that I'm going to be open for re-evaluation in the near future. I did pick up the Arrow release, which and watch the extended version, which I think is as close as we're ever going to get to any kind of Peckinpah vision. And it's a fine package, beautiful transfer and a great soundtrack. Now, in terms of 70mm notes, there is slightly some, I think there might be some film historian work required on this one. There is a listing for a 70mm blow up with a six track magnetic soundtrack in Spain. And as I understand, it played in 70mm at the Cinerama Dome. However, I have noticed it has been removed from in 70mm blow-up list, so I don't know if there is some kind of bone of contention there or some controversy. It may require far more research. I'm trying to look for kind of like flyers that might have advertised the Cinerama Dome screening. It does seem a little bit odd to me that if it was shown in 70mm there would only be one print, but of course there is that Spanish screening, so I'm not quite sure. It may well be that I have included this film in the 70mm festival by mistake. And again, I'm only going on what I could find out, so if I ever get to the bottom of it, I will of course update.
They said he was scheming, pushing, medal hunting, brash. A young man in too much of a hurry. A young rebel who did things his own way and be damned.
You're my greatest disappointment. You lie. You shirk. You boast. What's to become of you, boy?
I often think the biopic is a tough genre in which to do a film well. If you are too in awe of your subject, the result is often a glorified love letter that becomes a rather superficial trawl through a given person's life. Indeed, recently there has been a slew of biopics actually endorsed and even produced by the subjects themselves, Bohemian Rhapsody being an example, whereby a film is almost too scared to really explore the subject it presents, in lieu of telling a rather sterile yarn that gives audience exactly what they want, a glorified Queen music video that grossed almost $1 billion, therefore proving me completely wrong that a warts and all version of the Queen story would have been better. The other pitfall can be attempted psychological investigations of a given person that tries to explain them somehow. Ridley Scott's Napoleon was a recent example of this for me. His real battle was one he was fighting with the love of his life, the Empress Josephine, in a film I would have enjoyed a lot more if it had dispensed with all the war stuff and was confined to one of their palaces. Oliver Stone's W is another attempt to explain George W. Bush in terms of a man simply wanting to impress his family. It's a rather shallow and dull mockumentary that fast becomes rather boring. The biopics I tend to love tend to be the ones that take a step back from their subjects to maintain a degree of objectivity. And it's a tough line to walk. Patton is easily my favourite of the genre. You're allowed to be revolted by the man, but the film captures a moment in time where perhaps, for better or worse, a man was truly fulfilling his destiny in the purest sense. Patton loves war, even the death and the glory that he feels come with it. He was despised and loved in equal measure by those around him, and the film never really asks you to pick a side. He's far too complex for that anyway. History is, of course, subjective to a degree. It's debated, re-evaluated, which is why I found revisiting Richard Attenborough's 1972 film Young Winston so interesting. Churchill is a divisive figure now in the modern age, but in 1972 he was still revered, and Young Winston has an incredibly nostalgic tone to it. Indeed, it feels somewhat old-fashioned for the time. This was the 70s and the age of the movie brat and New Hollywood. And Young Winston is anything of the sort. It is kind of an empire film in the vein of something like The Four Feathers at times. It's a period piece. It had some decidedly kitsch moments, some rather bizarre fourth wall breaking interviews with the characters that appear from time to time. And it's about a young man working his way through very much the establishment, which would inevitably have made people feel it was a film about privilege. Because make no mistake, this is a film about a white man born into huge wealth and his journey of social mobility to lord it over the plebs. But Churchill was no David Cameron. He was a genuinely interesting person. And the film is based on the book of his own life, which means therefore this journey is perhaps not unsurprisingly filled with derring do and adversity. And my biggest criticism of the film is how dutiful it feels to Churchill at times. We know, and I do firmly believe, that Churchill was a great wartime leader, and how can you not be moved by some of those speeches? So what Young Winston does is provide us with the context by which he became the man history would come to remember. Essentially, we have a film about character building. And Winston, played admirably by Simon Ward, is not the apple of his father's eye. Indeed, Lord Randolph Churchill, Robert Shaw, regards him as something of a disappointment. Indeed, the film does somewhat go full Freud on us. Young Winston is sent off to public school, whereby he learns by way of the cane that anything less than perfection will be met with hard discipline. There is no doubt, though, that these scenes are amongst the film's most touching. The young boy playing Winston truly evokes a sense of dread and indeed nagging sense of abandonment in the hopelessness and terror that he is experiencing. Yes, Winston was born into privilege, but the film makes an admirable case that money is no substitute for love and care, and Winston's mother, Lady Churchill, played by Anne Bancroft, is a mother of a peculiar kind. She loves her son, yes, but her love is inside the very strict social circle she inhabits, and her affection for Winston is subcontracted to the nanny with whom he has the most recognisable bond with. The workings of the upper class are often an alien world to mere mortals. Endless social occasion in which everyone is dressed to the nines, speaks only at the correct moment, and where strict codes of conduct are adhered to at all times. Young Winston shows us that despite being born into this life, Winston still had a common touch, and perhaps it was this that so enraged his father. And there is a constant quest to go out into the world and seek the danger and putting his life on the line for his country. And there's a degree of the warmonger about him. He seems to have a romantic ideal of war. And much like Teddy Roosevelt, he sees a kind of nobility in the suffering of conflicts, which rather plays down how terrible a thing it is. Yet these are oddities of these figures, that their contradiction in them intrigue us so much. And I do think young Winston suffers from being made at the time it was made. Again, this was a time when Winston Churchill was a godlike figure in the nation's psyche, and writer Carl Foreman completely understandably is making a film to celebrate the man rather than to truly interrogate his character and actions. Patton does this extraordinarily well. The character was always divisive, even his own soldiers despised him and loved him in equal measure. Winston, however, was adored, and this film is adoring. And through contemporary eyes, it can be a little bit too much on the nose. It includes arousing scores, with especially pieces by Elgar, and Attenborough's direction is decidedly non-New Hollywood. Now, I've always liked his films, and he's from the David Lean school of direction. He's old school, and he shoots epic brilliantly, and he can make an interior office feel like the size of a football pitch. And I do feel like, in the context of the material, Attenborough is probably the right man for the job. It's doing service to Churchill. It's not cynical. And yes, it's a rather patriotic film. It did huge business in Britain. And it also bagged a slew of awards, a Golden Globe and some Oscar nominations, including one for Carl Foreman. Overall, I like it. I've owned a DVD, and now the Blu-ray from Powerhouse, released a few years ago, looks and sounds as good as the film has ever been on home video, and is well worth picking up if it ever comes up in a sale. It was released on 70mm with a 6-track stereo surround sound, and I have not seen any recent 70mm prints doing the round, and I have a feeling this may be one of those films that will never be seen on 70mm again. But overall, Young Winston is well worth a good bank holiday viewing. So often I watch films, either at the cinema or in my film room, and become consciously aware of the fact that the film I'm watching lacks a certain something. And that something is cinematic. The stories might be good, and I might well be invested in them, yet so many and so often look so very pedestrian. An average film can be saved from tedium if it looks the part. Zabriskie Point is, on a good day, a somewhat silly film, but by God, it looks gorgeous. So much, in fact, I sometimes wonder if I may have watched Zabriskie Point more than any other film over the past 5 years. And I do sometimes wonder if it's my favourite Michelangelo Antonioni film, even if it is a million miles away from La Ventura. And when I often have one of these uncinematic cinematic experiences, I often find myself having to watch films written or directed by John Milius. Respected, revered, and loathed in equal measure, this man has given us some of cinema's most memorable moments. Quint's monologue in Jaws, Charlie Don't Surf, Conan, and of course Red Dawn, an absurd film in which the Soviets invade America and are fought off by a group of school children. It's an adolescent wish fulfillment at best, and possibly why it was so popular, and why even to this day I can't help but watch it every now and then. I love John Milius. He is a genius, and a crazy one at that. And you have to really ask yourself, can you be a genius without being somewhat crazy to boot? Milius made claims of being cancelled for being right-wing in a leftist town, an industry, but in reality, he was a man who may have just about deserved it, and even if some of the stories about him are true, Clint Eastwood and Arnold Schwarzenegger hardly had their careers flounder for espousing their political views. All being said, though, I wish he had a bigger filmography. His talent is enviable, and he lives and breathes a truly cinematic existence. I want Larger Than Life, and Milius and his films are in every way. After the success of his debut directorial film Dillinger, Milius made what I consider to be his most personal film, 1975's The Wind and the Lion. I say personal because it's an incredibly romantic film, and Milius is a romantic. He clearly has a reverence for the American ideal of ruggedness, masculinity, adventure, and yes, conflict. The Wind and the Lion is loosely based on a true story, and is a geopolitical action adventure film set in Morocco. The Razuli, played by Sean Connery, wants to overthrow the corrupt Sultan and his son after they've become too beholden to Western values. He kidnaps a woman called Eden Pedicaris, played by Candice Bergman, and her son and daughter, hoping to provoke an international response. Meanwhile, Teddy Roosevelt in America, played by Brian Keith, is seeking re-election and sees in the incident a chance to score some points. He demands that Pedicaris is either returned or the Razuli killed, and decides to send in the Marines to reassert American influence in the region. Yet he sees a kindred spirit in the Razuli, and alone they're never meeting, the pair strike a bond of mutual admiration. The Wind and the Lion is a silly film in some regards, not in a way that offends the intelligence, but in the way films sometimes wear their daftness as a badge of honour. Sean Connery is Sean Connery. He's a movie star so big, you're not even asking your audience to believe he is anyone else. And as the Razuli, he bears no resemblance to the actual man, and Connery doesn't even bother to hide that Scottish accent. Yet you go with it, because it is a bit silly, and silly at the movies can be fun when it's done as well as it is here. We can tell everyone is going to fall in love with the Razuli, and Candice Bergman is too good looking not to, but Milius knows romance between the two is off the card, so he lets the camera do the framing and gives the Razuli a never-ending stream of ultra-wide, worshipping Panavision shots. Yet Milius believes in the power of the movie star with such certainty and devotion to the medium that you don't care that the pair never share a kiss. It's the movies we are in love with, and in case like this, we just want the good guys to win and the bad guys to lose. And all this is a boys' film anyway. Who needs a kiss? We've got shootouts and sword fighting to enjoy.
Venison and a cougar. Heard about the bear, have you?
Big one, I heard.
Coffee, Mr. President?
Is that the bear?
Yes, this is the bear that attacked the horse camp at dawn. He knew that men would be asleep, or at their worst, at dawn. As you know, he injured one of the Indians quite severely. He killed several of the horses, too.
Did you yourself participate in stopping the bear, Mr. President?
Yes, I regret to say.
Why do you regret, Mr. President?
Because he's a fine creature. This is his valley. This valley belonged to the bear, and we're the intruders here. We're accustomed to wild animals taking flight at the sight of men with guns. The American grizzly fears nothing. Not man, not guns, not death.
Do you intend to have this bear as a rug in the White House, Mr. President?
Rug? No. No, I intend to have him stuffed and placed on exhibit at the Smithsonian Institute. The American grizzly bear is a symbol of the American character. Strength, intelligence, ferocity. A little blind and reckless at times. But courageous beyond all doubt. On one other trait that goes with all previous.
And that, Mr. President?
Loneliness. A bear lives out his life alone. Indomitable, unconquered, but always alone. He has no real allies, only enemies, but none of them are as great as he.
You feel this might be an American trait?
Certainly. The world would never love us. They respect us. They may even grow to fear us. They will never love us. We have too much audacity.
Milius's contemporary and friend Steven Spielberg believes in a Jimmy Stewart, Frank Capra version of the American Male. And in the excellent speech you just heard by Brian Keith as Teddy Roosevelt, Milius clearly tells us his version of the American Male. And you have to ask yourself, who would you rather be? Close Encounters' Roy Neary or Teddy Roosevelt? It's hard to see anyone really picking the former. But he believes in a very specific type of American masculinity. Teddy Roosevelt was a warmonger. Milius never went to Vietnam. It clearly bothered him. And I can easily imagine him being chafed by the opening words of Franklin J. Schaffner's Patton, where we learn Americans love war, as George C. Scott tells his men. And Milius ended up not going to Vietnam due to medical reasons. And it's these reasons now that so often seem to be such a thing of shame. So in Teddy Roosevelt, he sees a cipher. This isn't just any military intervention too. It's for a good cause, the perfect type of intervention, until they're not. It's also a love letter to Teddy Roosevelt, and what a better way to send it with such a gorgeous looking film. Keith is superb as Teddy Roosevelt, and he's a man seemingly born for the widescreen age, a historical character who in any other form of framing would seem somehow disrespected. It's interesting that Roosevelt in the film sees some of himself in the Rizzuti, and you can tell he is smitten with the renegade, and maybe Milius sees himself in the Rizzuti too, fighting against the system, a man destined to be an outlaw, yet admired for his unwavering belief. Could Milius's ego be so big that he even had Teddy Roosevelt in the film, admiring him in the form of the Rizzuti? I wouldn't rule it out. You can see Milius's influences as well all over The Wind and the Lion. It has occasional goofiness, mainly from Sean Connery, that remind me of the type of thing you get in John Ford. The violence is, to use a cliche, Peckinpah-esque. And even D.W. Griffith, I think, in the film's grandeur, which is supposed my way of saying it's a classic American film. Now, possibly it's more his writing he is known for, but Milius is a good director. Apocalypse Now is not as good without Coppola. With Milius at the helm, maybe we still would have had the epic, but I doubt it could have been intimate as it would be in Milius' hands. But nonetheless, The Wind and the Lion is a film painted in broad strokes where Milius is more than up to the task to deliver. I do genuinely love this film. It's not great. It doesn't need to be. It's often a thing of beauty to look at. It's entertaining, well acted, and above all, it's incredibly good fun. They don't make them like this anymore because they've forgotten in many respects why it is people go to the cinema in the first place. Not for a lecture on history, gender or politics, but because for 2 hours sometimes people just want spectacle and fun. Not necessarily to leave our brains at the door, I might add, but for the screen to whisk us off to some fun place in time. A place so daft that Sean Connery can have a Scottish accent playing an Arab warlord. You can pick up the Blu-ray of The Wind on the Lion on the Warner Archives. I have a feeling this film has never been released on Blu-ray in the UK, so I'm hopeful that now that the Warner Archive is releasing films in Britain, this one might well make an appearance. In terms of 70mm notes, this film was released quite extensively in the US on 70mm. The last time it was screened, the most recent screening in 70mm was in 1991 in Portland. I do believe as well, I was chatting to someone recently about this film who said that this had one of the best 6-track stereophonic soundtracks that they heard on 70mm. So I hope one day perhaps it does make a reappearance on the circuit. But overall, The Wind and the Lion by John Milius, as I said, I absolutely adore this film, and I have a feeling if you haven't seen it, you might too. And that's going to be it for the first part. There will now be an intermission, and I will come back with part 2 very shortly. Thanks, bye.